Luno, the fastest, easiest way to buy Bitcoin. If you're just getting into crypto, it's the perfect place to start. Hey guys, and welcome back to the Leia Heilpern Show. As you can see, I have a really great guest today. Previous CTO of Coinbase, entrepreneur, angel investor. Previously at Andreessen Horowitz, it is Balogis. Balogis, how are you doing?
Hey, how are you doing, Leia?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Before we jump in, I just want to let everybody know that this is powered by Icon Plus Capital, the VC firm, also sponsored by BlockFi. So you can actually get up to $250 when you sign up, which is pretty cool because they offer really great interest rates. And if you are watching on YouTube, please don't forget to subscribe, hit the like button so you never miss a brilliant guest. So Balogis, welcome to the show. Where are you based right now?
Undisclosed location, but I'm in Asia.
Okay, cool. And when I was doing loads of research, trying to figure out, okay, you know, what we're going to talk about, there's so much to discuss with you. You have so many interesting opinions on many different topics, a lot of opinions which I share. So I figured I'd sort of just free flow with this and kind of see where we land. I want to go back a bit. You were the previous CTO of Coinbase. How did you get into this space?
So I've been interested in this kind of stuff for a long time. You know, I learned about, the Fed and other types of stuff from Ron Paul in the 2000s. But, I always thought that in the Fed was idealistic, but a little impractical. And then I really understood it much more after the financial crisis. And even still, you know, the Fed is it's like the center, it's this hub with literally millions of spokes coming into it. So just in the Fed, I don't think was practical, but to exit the Fed and build like an alternate hub, like over here, that had a bunch of connections coming into it, like what Bitcoin is, that actually would be practical. And so, you know, basically when Bitcoin, came out, there's a lot of things that are on one's radar. I really started paying much more attention to it after it recovered from the crash in prices. The first one, like it went up to $32 in the 2011, crashed down to $2, but then it recovered up. And so I got much more heavily into it around that time. And I actually taught a Stanford class starting in late 2012, early 2013, that included Bitcoin as a component. I still have some of my lectures from that online. And then of course, Bitcoin took off in a huge way in 2013. And that pulled me into the space basically full time for essentially the last 8 years.
I think
a lot of venture capital and other things on the side, but let's say the through line for the last 8 years has been cryptocurrency.
And it's changed so much since then, but not just the space, but the world has changed. And you have this sort of Orwellian kind of perception of how the world is right now. And I sort of share that to an extent. So I just want to understand why you have that perception. What is it that's going on in this world right now that makes you think, oh God, you know, we're going down a bit of a dark path?
Well, I would basically say, I might slightly rephrase to say, it's not so much that it's my perception is that the world is in some ways becoming Orwellian. Not so much that, you know, like I desire an Orwellian kind of thing.
Yes.
So, what's interesting is, basically, I actually think it's kind of bimodal, you know, that Tale of Two Cities, thing, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. I think what's happening is all the futures are happening, right? The extreme dystopian cyberpunk surveillance state, where drones whiz by overhead, everything is tracked, and you have to barcode scan to enter a store. Somebody can hit a button and pull up everything. You can be deleted from the internet. I mean, you could have cash that can be deleted from your account and you can be unfortunately, all those things that I've just described have either happened or are on pace to happen. Okay. China is a sneak preview of some of these things are happening in the US, et cetera. So that kind of total state sort of thing is also happening. On the other hand, you have extreme points of light, right? We have, things like, Boom Supersonic is, finally getting supersonic aircraft again. We have, what technology is doing in terms of, I'm actually a big booster of biomedicine, such as vaccines, but artificial eyes, cochlear implants to restore hearing. The life extension stuff is moving along. We have lots of discoveries in biomedicine, like, restoring muscle and things like that, myostatin and things I've tweeted about. And of course, there's, you know, cryptocurrency and automating Wall Street and, you know, replacing the Fed with, you know, digital gold, something that they can't print. And, you know, there's drones and there's autonomous robotics. There's so many good things happening. Yeah. Where you have a possible vision of a society where we've actually eliminated a lot of sources of scarcity that have plagued us, of which the most important is scarce life. But you have both of those things happening at the same time. And actually, Peter Thiel, you know, it's funny, he had a very prescient remark 10 years ago where, you know, at the time I thought it was just kind of a projection of his personality, but maybe it's just one of those things where oftentimes the things that tech people do, everybody else does 5 or 10 or 20 years later, right?
Yeah.
So Thiel basically said, I think it was 2009, that the world is in a deadly race between politics and technology. And that the race may be very close, even down to the wire, and that the future may depend on the efforts of one person who makes the world safer capitalism. This was 2 months after Satoshi Nakamoto had put up the, you know, Bitcoin Genesis block. At the time, nobody really knew how big it was going to be, perhaps other than, you know, Satoshi or Hal Finney. But, you know, like what Peter was thinking about was Patrick Friedman's work on seasteading, which is actually, I think, also very important in the fullness of time, will become very important, is very important, but it's got a longer burn. But Satoshi was basically that person, I think, who made the world safer capitalism. The point being, you know, Thiel, why did he talk about this like down to the wire kind of thing? Part of it is due to his experience at PayPal, where he closed a funding round for PayPal like a few days before the dot-com crash happened. It was very much down to the wire. And because of that, PayPal is, you know, like a whatever billion-dollar company today. It's in the tens. I haven't checked the latest valuation. So it's like a massive company today. It obviously influenced Bitcoin. It influenced Stripe. It influenced basically every fintech company. And it gave birth to the entire PayPal mafia, which was, you know, Reid Hoffman and Keith Raboy and Max Levchin and all these guys who've done LinkedIn and Square. Like, just this absolutely incredible diaspora. But it could all have died had he not closed that round literally the day before the thing collapsed, right? He just felt something that made him push, mm-hmm. you know? And so that model of the world is something which I find really interesting. And, you know, as I said, at the time, I thought it was just because of Peter's personal experience that he projected that. But it seems that projection is correct. And perhaps the high upside, high downside lifestyle of the tech entrepreneur became more common and more common still, such that that becomes basically everybody's lifestyle and is becoming everybody's lifestyle today, with all the pros and cons of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so I want to go back a second because you mentioned China and you sort of said that this Orwellian state hasn't fully arrived, but you feel it could be coming, we could be going down that direction. And you do speak a lot about being this freedom maximalist, freedom of speech. You don't necessarily call yourself a Bitcoin maximalist, but it's freedom maximalism. So in terms of what you feel is coming here, what would you say is, because I know you said that it's, we're sort of seeing a mirror of it, of what could be in China, whether it's, you know, policing of speech, you know, policing of, I guess you're sort of saying that we see this a bit in the cryptocurrency community as well, like this wokeism policing of what you can and can't say.
Yeah. So on that, basically, I think it's not just, I think in many ways, unfortunately, I tweeted about this a while ago, but I think it's even more evidence today. In many ways, actually, CCP and NYT are on a convergence, right? Why do I say NYT? Because they're the ones really kind of pushing for a lot of this stuff in the US government, and actually a lot of major tech companies are downstream of them. And so I kind of think of a triangle as, you know, communist capital, woke capital, crypto capital. Like, these are three points on this triangle. And, you know, so communist capital is CCP. It's very simple. It is, you must submit, okay?
Yeah.
Total state, bend before the Communist Party, and then you can go and make money. Not too much nowadays. Make too much, you'll get on their radar. So that actually, that ceiling is descending quickly, right? But that's basically their social contract, right? They don't have the concept of, like, quote, limited government, or even the rhetoric around it that is there in the West. It's basically Marxist-Leninist, you know. They're like Agent Smith from The Matrix, right? A chair can turn into a Communist Party guy if they wanted to, right? Like, you can be interrogated for violating the law, right? Or what they've decided is the law. So long as you don't contest their power, it's actually extremely straightforward. Then, you know, you can basically just go about your life, you know, make money, you know, have family, whatever, right? That's their social contract. I'm not saying it's good. Obviously, if you're a Uyghur, that's not the social contract. But that's essentially how, like, you know, the, let's say you're your defender or even your neutral person in the regime would tend to express it. Okay. Now, woke capital is another poll, and woke capital is you must sympathize. And the difference is with the CCP, they say that they are powerful, and therefore that's why you must submit. With woke capital, it says something different. It says you are powerful because you are white, because you are male, because you are straight, because you are cis, because you've made some money, or because you're X or Y or Z, some immutable characteristic or some hard to change characteristic. Because of that characteristic, you are powerful, and therefore you must apologize. And what's interesting is both the CCP and the woke, you know, like even though they come at it from very different points, they end with downcast eyes, right? Like, you know, CCP is you must submit, cast your eyes down. Woke capital says you're powerful, so you must apologize, again, cast your eyes down. So both fundamentally ideologies of submission, though the woke version of it is much more subtle, right? It's not that subtle, but it's more subtle, right? It's not that subtle today, but I think articulating it in this way is it's fundamentally something where you can throw at somebody to get them to bend, right? Bend their head. Okay. Now, the third poll is, and by the way, woke capital, I don't think of it as fundamentally driven by the state per se. It's really driven by legacy, you know, media corporations, I would argue, especially NYT, as a primary expense of this. Paul Graham actually retweeted something, you know, a few years ago, tweeted out, which you can probably find it on Twitter if you do, From: Paul G. Space Hypothesis. And, you know, he shows that a bunch of woke words just kind of rose vertically. Actually, I'm not sure if you can project this on screen. Here we go. I found the link.
Oh, I don't know if I can, unless I don't think you can.
Okay.
Are they words like, is it words like, I don't know. Oh, you said something.
It's hypothesis, although some newspapers can survive the switch to online subscriptions, none can do it and remain a politically neutral, quote, newspaper of record. You have to pick a side to get people to subscribe. And the thing is, if you look at this, you basically see all these words and phrases that were used before just going completely vertical. And it has controls also. It has things like China or Amazon, where you'd sort of expect them to be on an exponential, or General Motors, it's kind of coming down, right? But, you know, like white privilege, just totally vertical, right? White national, white, totally vertical.
It's triggering. I'm just going to say some words so people know, because they won't be able to see it. So you've got misogyny, sexist, patriarchy, mansplaining, toxic masculinity, male privilege, feminism, women empowerment, racism, institutional racism, transphobia, homophobia, Islamophobia, hate speech, hurtful, offensive, triggering, traumatizing, all of the fun words that we have these days.
All the stuff. And the thing is that basically what that coincides with is 2013, which is, you know, my friend Aram Sabeti had a very trenchant observation, which is racism wasn't a new problem, but the New York Times' declining stock price in 2012 was. Like, if you go and look at their stock price, okay, that's the thing. You look at their stock price, and around that time, the Washington Post had been sold for basically fire sale prices to Bezos, right? It looked like media was down on one knee. You know, tech had taken all this revenue from them. There's a great chart, if you Google tech media, you know, print disruption, essentially print dropped from like about $67 billion in revenue to like $18 billion in revenue over 4 years after the financial crisis. And Google and Facebook and the iPhone all went vertical like this. And that's why, you know, Bezos, among others, could buy the Washington Post, this great crown jewel, not with Amazon.com, but out of his own pocket, right? Petty cash. He had $250 to spend on this thing, right? So this was like a humiliating moment. Guys like Jack Schaefer were calling on Sulzberger, for example, the Sulzberger family, which owns the Times, to sell the New York Times, right? And in this moment, you know, what they basically did, whether, you know, do I put it all on them? No, you know, there's aspects of this that were bubbling on Tumblr and, you know, Gawker and, you know, Something Awful. And, you know, there's also a political campaign waged in 2012 that pushed a bunch of these buttons in order to, I think, get out the vote, right? So all those things were there. But what happened was, just like a restaurant owner might spike their food with sugar and salt, large portions, which make them more profit, and you have a short-term engagement with the store because you're eating more, it's tastier, etc. Long-term, however, they're externalizing the healthcare cost, the diabetes or the heart disease or what have you onto you, right? Like the eater. In the same way, what happened in 2013 is they started spiking the media diet, your information diet, with these nerve-jangling words and phrases that just agitate, right? They polarize and they get hate clicks on both sides. And you know what? Like, if it bleeds, it leads. If it enrages, it engages. Now, I want to be clear that certainly tech is not to blame for this. The social media environment also was set up for this. Basically, when two people punch each other out on Twitter over some news story, who profits? Legacy media corporations and social media companies, right? They get, I don't know, 10 bucks in clicks for two people like stabbing each other's reputation online. It's like a boxing promoter has two people knock each other's, you know, brains out, and they make money, right? And so essentially what has happened is over the last 8 years, legacy media and social media have literally made billions of dollars while they like rent society to shreds and all of the social trust has gone down, right? So this is basically now, and then into that place when trust is low, the total state steps in, right? So that's kind of both NYT itself and woke capital, but let me come back to this triangle, right? So with the woke capital poll, what's interesting is despite claiming some huge rhetorical difference, you know, from China, there's a lot of convergence of the two. You know, I tweeted this like, I think 2 or 3 years ago. Let me see if I can find this. Let's see. Some weird ways, about, you know, China. Yeah, here we are. Neither side wants to admit it, but the U.S. and China are converging in some weird ways. Internet censorship, nationalism and socialism, state takeover of tech companies, social credit versus cancel culture, human flesh search, and Twitter moms, right? So just to define some of those things, you know, everyone's like, oh my God, it's so dystopian that the Chinese have the social credit system. Cancel culture is just a decentralized version of the same thing. That's one way of thinking about it, right? And, you know, when with real consequences, people can get banned from platforms or deplatformed, and it just so happens that all the companies do it at the same time, right? So China is centralized censorship by the state. It's like overt and in your face, right? In the U.S., because of the First Amendment, what has evolved is a totally different system that's very substantively similar, namely decentralized censorship by tech companies. Okay, and you know, the third poll, which I'll get to, is decentralized censorship resistance by Bitcoin and crypto protocols. Okay, but another thing I mentioned: human flesh search and Twitter mobs. So human flesh search is a concept in China, which is basically like a Twitter mob hunting for somebody online to find that they said something awful, right? Now, the exact moral things you can get canceled for in China are very different than in the US. Like in China, it's something related to Taiwan. In the US, it's, you know, it was saying like Latinx or something stupid like this, you know, which actually Hispanic people don't say, you know?
Yeah.
So it differs, or for not saying Latinx, you know what I mean? It differs, but the substance is similar. Okay, should I get to the third poll, crypto capital?
Yeah, do it.
All right. So just jump in anytime because I will go. Okay. All right.
No. Okay. Fine. I'll jump in after the third poll. Go on.
Okay. Great. So the third poll, just to recap, we have CCP. We have, let me do it. So this is the mirror. Okay. It's all mirror image. We have CCP, right? We have CCP, we have NYT, and then we have BTC. Okay. Those are like the three polls, right? Communist capital, world capital, crypto capital. And if communist capital says you must submit, and woke capital says you must sympathize, crypto capital says you must be sovereign. Okay.
Yeah.
So while the other two tell you that you have to bow your head, this actually says you have to hold up your chin. Okay. Now there's a lot of good in this, right? There's a lot of obligation in this. You have to hold your own private keys. You have to, you know, like basically think for yourself when it comes to, for example, food rather than eating carbohydrates. You have to realize actually the things that society advises you to do, like take out the, you know, 30-year mortgage or, you know, be in debt for the rest of your life and student loans, that debt is actually pretty bad in general and that you should prefer equity and saving money to getting into debt. That, you know, things like, you know, the food pyramid, as I mentioned, like these things are wrong. And there's a lot of good to this, right? The issue is even that can be taken to an extreme because if you, you know, if everybody has to be sovereign for everything at all times, there is no, there's no collective action, there's no shared goods, there's no community of any kind. In extremists, for example, you know, people actually, so just as a thought experiment, if there was no ability whatsoever to regulate food and drugs, you would have to basically bring your own portable dipstick into Starbucks to kind of poke it into the coffee to make sure that there wasn't some, you know, bad thing in there, right? That sounds like a caricature, but this is actually why people in China, for example, often buy food from the West because they don't actually trust like Chinese baby formula, you know, after some scandals of like melamine and so on there, right? So that might sound like a caricature, and certainly relative to, you know, America's FDA, you know, we could do something better with better type 1 and type 2, you know, rates. But in practice, what people actually want is a, quote, regulated marketplace in the sense of an actor that gives star ratings of, you know, actors, and it bans bad actors. What's my point? Basically, the form of that regulator doesn't necessarily have to be a nation state regulator. It can be an internationalist capitalist regulator. In a sense, eBay, for example, is a regulator of their marketplace. They give star ratings and ban bad actors, right? PayPal has fraud reviews. Amazon has reviews of books and they ban bad actors. You know, Uber and Airbnb do the same thing. These are cloud regulators, internationalist capitalist regulators, not nation state based regulators. Mm-hmm. Achieve some of the same functions, and they do so in a competitive marketplace where exit is the overall governor. If you don't like Uber's regulation, you go to Lyft, right? If you don't like Airbnb's regulation, there's other kind of, you know, services that you can use. Point being that the extremists of you must be sovereign basically takes no regulation to the point of denying that people actually want some kind of third-party quality control, right? They want to contract somebody to do it. They don't necessarily want to do it themselves, but denying that that even exists can be one failure mode. Another failure mode is on things like COVID, right? Where one of the things that's really difficult that I find is, unless you're a scientist, right? And, you know, I have a background in genomics and bioinformatics and what have you. So I felt well equipped to go and read the primary literature, read things with a grain of salt, diligent things, say, that's a bad paper, that's a good paper, that's really interesting, this maps what I know. But I have a lot of sympathy for people who, you know, I don't know, let's say this was earthquake geophysics, okay? Mm-hmm. That would be an area where I know, you know, enough physics, you know, physics of waves and so on to probably get into it. But would I be able to, you know, really get in there right away and look at the data? Not at the same level, right? Not as much as in bioinformatics, right? Where I have a lot of experience. So I'm very sympathetic to people who are caught between either zero trust or total trust. Right. And most people can't have like intermediate levels of trust in something. Their trust is either broken or it's present, you know. And so what happened with the government is when they went and with the US government, all Western governments, when all this official misinformation came out, masks don't work before they do, COVID is contained, and now it's there. Everybody has to stay at home, but you can go out to protest, but you have to stay at home. But the governor doesn't have to. People can see the inconsistencies on this. And so I'm sympathetic to those people who just now distrust the state, but that's a failure mode of you must be sovereign, because we're just social animals. We can't all figure it out for ourselves. So what I think about is what I call the decentralized center. Okay. So in these kind of three poles of this triangle, right, PRC, NYT, BTC, you want the decentralized center where it is, you know, it's not exactly moderates, because it's going to be quite different from like the moderate world of, you know, 1990 or 1980, it's a different kind of center. But it's something which is like you have a society that takes the people who were exiled from each of these three kind of quadrants, right? The people like Jack Ma, right, who in China, you know, not just Jack Ma, but all the 100,000 whatever entrepreneurs and crypto Chinese who exist, by the way, there's not just communist Chinese, there's crypto Chinese, people who are much like you and I with similar mores, they just live in China, right? So we shouldn't just think of it all being bad people. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of very good people there, right? I mean, it's an obvious point, but some of the rhetoric around it, I think, says the Chinese doing this, the Chinese doing that. And I think it's important to distinguish CCP from your average Chinese person, many of whom are very cosmopolitan and positive sum. So something, you want something which is appealing to them. You want something that's appealing to people who are tolerant, but not woke. And you want people, something that's appealing to people who are libertarian, but not, you know, in favor of crypto anarchy, right? Now, why do I say that, right? Crypto anarchy is cool, but I prefer crypto civilization. Okay, crypto anarchy, you know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay, so crypto anarchy for your viewers, and by the way, again, jump in because I'll just go, okay?
Wait, actually, I'm gonna go back then half a second though, because I don't wanna go too far just yet. Just pause on the crypto anarchy. I just wanna focus on the whole idea of this woke culture just for a second. Because it's not so obvious to some people. And for me, whenever I'm looking online and I'm reading Twitter and I see tweets like yours, people who share similar ideas, it's always really refreshing. And I don't understand why, because you said it's a bit more subtle. compared to the CCP, which isn't so subtle. For me, it's the same thing. It's just different, right? Like it's communism and it's exactly the same thing. And it's what's coming over here to the West. But it's done with this whole, you know, you must submit because, you know, you're privileged and it's not fair and we've got to help and we've got to be kind. It's comes from a more moral standpoint. So my question is, why isn't it so obvious? Because you kind of brushed past this as if it's so obvious, as if, you know, yeah, we can easily compare this to the CCP and what's happening there, but it's not so obvious to some people, even in the crypto community. It's not so obvious. People wearing masks and things like that in like profile pictures and all these things, you know, like there's a lot of signaling going on and it's not always so obvious to people. So why would you say that it is a bad thing?
Okay, great question. So first, one thing I would observe, so actually David Shore was a pretty smart guy on the, you know, Democrat side. You know, I wouldn't consider myself to have any political labels, but I was able to actually note something after the election that most people wouldn't be able to note, which is actually the Democrats actually gained in the white vote and Republicans actually gained on the minority side, right? Okay, well, so that's contrary to a lot of the narrative or what have you. And what I think is interesting about this is I think we're starting to see something which is sort of like these extremely woke white people who are expiating sins real or imagined for, you know, inheriting money or something like that. Like a lot of these people are like Choate and Andover and Exeter or whatever grads. And you find that it is the privileged whites who call out, quote, other people's white privilege the most, right? The mm-hmm. privileged whites are most concerned with other people's white privilege. And this is a weird form of expiating their own guilt because they know that they inherited something, they didn't found it. But the way they expiate that guilt is conveniently by tearing down other people, right? By tearing down, you know, some poor Southern guy or some guy in the Midwest or you know, some plumber in New York as being, quote, white privilege, as if they actually were, you know, going to Exeter and Choate and so on and so forth, right? So that's one aspect of it. The second aspect is that, you know, people like, you know, yourself or myself who have some intersectional credential, right? Like, you know, being non-white or a woman or what have you, right? And actually that's a vast majority of the world. If you think about it, only something like, depending on how you count, less than 20% of the world is white. I don't know the exact percentage. Something like 80% is, quote, people of color, right? And then you add women and so on and so forth. Almost everybody has like some intersectional credential, okay?
Yeah.
Because of that, we can sort of, we have like some shield or armor in this stupid social media game, right?
Yeah.
The third thing as to why this thing is popular is, do you know the concept of immune escape for viruses?
No.
Okay. So a virus can be targeted by like a vaccine,
yeah.
but it can develop a mutation that lets it wiggle out of that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, essentially it mutates and now it's escaped your immune system or it's escaped the vaccine. Okay. This is actually something I tweeted about the other day. So if you think of communism and wokeism as mind viruses, okay, basically people, I think this is actually a very deep concept. I'm going to go deep on this for a second, right? But if you think of them as mind viruses, yes, wokeism has structural similarities to communism. Okay. But there's some fundamental differences that have led it immune escape. If you think about it, much of the world was vaccinated against communism over the course of the 20th century at the cost of 100 million dead. You know, if you read, you know, Stephen Courtois' book, I think it's Courtois, the Black Book of Communism, right? You remember who wrote it.
Okay, that's interesting. So you're saying we're vaccinated against communism. I see where you're going with this. Okay.
Partially, right? But the thing is, wokeism versus communism. So communism was the redistribution of wealth. Wokeism is the redistribution of status, right? Communism was ostensibly for workers and peasants. Wokeism is ostensibly for women and, quote, minorities like yourself and myself, right? Communism was about the union strike, and wokeness is about the woke mob. Communism's setting was a factory floor, and wokeness's setting is social media. And so the thing is, why did communism spread? If you actually go back and look at it, I mean, this thing started with a book, and it grew to control an enormous swath of the Earth's, you know, surface, right? The USSR, China, Cuba, like this thing did appeal to people. It did, quote, win against, you know, more practical philosophies. Why is that the case, right? And part of the reason is, it's not the only reason, there's several reasons. Part of that is the microeconomic incentives for communism, okay? So that's to say, If you were like a Jurgis Rudkus, do you know who that is?
No.
Okay, so from this book, Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, right? If you go and read that book, you'll get a sense of what attracted people to communism. These guys were working in factories. They were going to this wrenching transition of the Industrial Revolution. They were alienated from their farms and their homes. You know, sometimes children were being worked really hard. There were disasters like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. And so much opprobrium was heaped on the unethical owner who had all this leverage and could, you know, bankrupt you or, you know, put you out of work. And, you know, the family farm that you had wanted that was now being bankrupted by these big factories that, you know, or big, you know, industrial operations, you just couldn't make it as a family farm anymore, right? All those were real things. And so, you know, what happened was some guy came into a factory and they basically say, we've got the answer, it's communism. And here's why. You build a union and do strikes. And then what you'll do? Everybody here will get some money. Why? Because you'll make that boss bend, that boss who's so powerful. All of us together are strong, you know, and we'll make him bend. And now we all get raises. Whoa, oh my God, the strike worked. Holy cow. And that would get reported in all the communist papers. And everybody would, you know, like, you know, raise their fist. Oh, we did it. And then the hangover the next day or the next week or so would happen because you'd have union dues, right? That would actually be coming out of your paycheck. That was increased. Now it's decreased. You have a second boss, which is like the union manager on top of the other manager, right? You suddenly have speech and thought controls. So Elia Kazan had this movie on this in the mid-20th century called On the Waterfront. You ever heard of it?
No.
Okay. Worth watching simply to get a sense of that time and place, where basically you'd be canceled for totally different things, but essentially being disloyal to the union, or, you know, which could expand into lots of things, like being working a little too hard, you know, and trying to make us look bad, you know, all of those kinds of things, right? You can start to see how that would be cause for cancellation, and you'd lose status among the other workers. And so the combination of all these things meant that your factory, your company became less competitive over time. But what you're basically doing with a strike is debiting from the future to build the present. Now, with that said, a strike is a pressure tactic. What the workers, the communist workers, thought was happening at that time, they thought it was a zero-sum situation where the boss would lose and they would win. It turned out to actually be a negative-sum situation where they were actually harming both parties over the long term, including themselves, by making the company less competitive. But they didn't understand that because they could only see it was a negative-sum situation with a short-term positive gain. It's like getting in a very high interest rate credit card kind of thing. You get the money today. It sort of tricks the psyche, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's like part of the microeconomics of it. The other aspect, of course, is the religious zeal. You know, Nietzsche wrote in the late 1800s, quote, God is dead. And what he was observing was he wasn't actually inveighing against God in that particular, you know, epistle. He was basically saying, you know, there's enough educated people who don't believe that there's going to be wars beyond imagining. People are going to look to fill effectively that God-shaped hole. And what a lot of people did is they filled their worship of God with GOV, right? With the government, right? The government can do everything, right? There's an ad a while back, which was government is the thing we all belong to, right? And so essentially people project onto it this monotheistic thing of the all father, right? The everything. You know,
yeah.
And so they basically they're quote secular, but they actually believe in this thing as Green Lantern because it's like the most powerful thing, right? They literally worship, you know, the government, right? So that's the second aspect in the vacuum of God, people projected all of this power onto this thing. Okay, so these are some of the reasons communism spread. Now let's bring it to wokeness, right? Wokeness has done a mean escape. It doesn't look exactly the same.
Yeah, I get that.
So for one thing, basically, do you know what the hard hat riot was, 1971?
No, I'm saying no to everything. My God, what is that?
So the hard hat riot is 1970, actually. So that was actually the flip, okay? Basically, for essentially about 70-something, actually more than 100 years, the working man and his noble nature, that was essentially like the backbone of communist, you know, revolutions all across the world, right?
Yeah.
But in 1970, an important flip happened, where union workers in the US came out to beat up the hippies who were protesting against the Vietnam War, which meant that union workers had basically been cut in to American prosperity enough that they didn't feel alienated like the guys from 50 years ago, right? This, by the way, you know, rather than the win-lose situation or the negative-sum situation, the win-lose situation is exploitative boss, right? The negative-sum situation, really lose-lose, is the union strike. The win-win is actually aligned capitalism, right? So the way to meet communism in the past, the way that actually worked was aligned capitalism, where to avoid this negative sum situation where you as a CEO or the executive are harmed and your workers are harmed, even if the strike organizers don't get it, you cut them in on the pot. This also eventually led to startups and to equity shares and so on and so forth, where you're not seeing that you are aligned, you're proving it by giving them a slice, right? I'll come back to this point. But basically that was actually, I think, the solution. Now, this is actually working well enough. Now, let me also give an asterisk, because I know some people are gonna say, that was working well until 1971, we got off the gold standard, then workers were no longer given such a cut. I agree, I'll come back to that. But let's just say, take it back to 1970, okay? So 1970, the hard hat riot, these guys, the union guys went out and beat up the hippies, and many people realized, wait a second, the host for the mind virus is no longer these white working class guys. So now they were like considered the most noble thing in the freaking world for basically 70 years, right? More than that, like 100 something years, that like all the bloodshed, everything was for them, the working man and so on and so forth, right? And all the faults were airbrushed. Now we suddenly saw a mirror image where this guy who was super noble became Archie Bunker. And all his negative traits were stressed. The racism, the sexism, the homophobia, yeah. These are all caricatures that, you know, like probably some truth to it, just there's probably some truth to the you know, the working man being oppressed by those bosses in some way. But these aspects now were stressed and it was flipped. And so the person who is, quote, the hero of the communist revolution became the villain of wokeness. And the mind virus switched hosts to now, right? So that's actually a very important thing, right? If you think about how much essentially the modern, you know, like wokes beat up on the white working class as being benighted and, you know, conservative and so on and so forth, that's a really important thing. And, you know, so in that flip, other things happen as well. The oppressed class theory switched from, you know, economics and, you know, workers and peasants to women and minorities, right? Now with wokeness, now studying wokeness for a second, why does it spread? How does something so irrational spread? Well, now we go to social media rather than the factory floor. The microeconomic incentives for wokeness are very simple. If you say that somebody is mansplaining, or, you know,
I hate that term so much. I hate that term.
I know, because it basically is something which essentially delegitimizes on the order of 50% of the world because of their immutable characteristics.
But it's not that, though. It's not that. It's not that like really makes my skin crawl. It's kind of just like the hypocrisy of it. Because like, right, it's still an offensive word. Like to say that, like if somebody said you're lady splaining, I would be like, ew, I'm doing what? Like it just, it's ironic. It's hypocritical because you're saying that he's being sexist by using a sexist term. But the thing with it spreading, which you know, we can get to, I think it was Yuri Bezmenov who said that people will never know what's arrived. So you and I know, probably most of the people listening and watching know, but I think he says you won't know what's arrived until you have physical harm inflicted on you. That's what he said. So if we take like COVID for an example, I don't really care what's happening. You know, like I don't really care whether it's real, it's not real, whether the numbers have been inflated, whether masks work or not. I don't care at this point. It's been 18 months and I just think we should all have our freedom back. But this is for me a prime example of what's happening. And even now, so in the UK, our news, it goes back and forward, how many died, how many haven't died. It's very contradictory, the data and everything. Even the rules across the world are contradictory. Wear masks inside, don't wear masks inside. Wear them outside, don't wear them outside. So even now, given everything that's happened with our civil liberties being taken away, people still are really blind to what's happening. And he says, Yuri Bezmenov says, until you actually have pain inflicted on you. It's kind of like walking to the gas chambers blind, basically. It's not until you're sort of there that you'll really be able to see what's happening. I don't know if you have an opinion on that. Do you think, you know, as this is spreading, people aren't going to wake up until, you know, communism really hits?
So a couple of thoughts on this. So basically, and it obviously doesn't have to be something as severe as, you know, the Holocaust, but it could just basically be a brick through your window. Actually, you know, with on the total reverse of that, like some of the anti-Israel stuff recently has gotten extreme. And that was a shift that wasn't obvious until this recent event where people were, you know, smashing windows and stuff and hitting people in the street. Couple of thoughts on this. So first on COVID, you know, in general, my stance on COVID is, I would say, the Asian stance, where it just hasn't been politicized in the same way it has in the West. And the response in general has been much more competent. Like if you look at a world map of, you know, deaths and so on from COVID, for the most part, Asia, especially East Asia, you know, like has done quite well. And I would include actually Australia and New Zealand in this. Now, what we'll come to is people will say, oh, well, they're islands. Well, the UK is also an island. Something about the Pacific Rim and the cultural influence there meant that people just kind of took this as a public health thing. And then they didn't lie to the citizens about masks don't work before they do and all the stuff, you know, that's there. But they also validated the citizens' trust by keeping the thing under control, you know? And so if you ask for the ball, you got to dunk it, right? If you ask for the trust, you actually have to validate the trust. And for the most part, Pacific Rim governments actually did better. Now, the reason I say that is I think of that as a third position, which is something which is not, I think, the silly politicized thing that's happened in the West. I'm sympathetic to your view. I'm also sympathetic to the view of somebody who's had somebody die from COVID and so thinks of it as very serious. It's like a fractal kind of thing where there's enormous variability in outcomes per person. There's, you know, like this is something which root causing the noise is actually quite difficult. Part of that is probably due to immunogenomics. That's to say, some people simply have more susceptibility than others, right? Part of it's due to things like diabetes or being overweight. Part of it's due to which variant you get, all this type of stuff. But that results in, though, is a highly stochastic environment where people have different microenvironments of what information they've received and what they've seen on COVID, what tracks their personal experience. And so I'm completely sympathetic, by the way, to the idea that this has been used by Western governments to erode freedoms. I also think that, you know, this is something that has killed whatever millions of people around the world. So it's like a real virus, and it's a base that could get more serious. That's to say, like, started out pretty bad and could get worse. Now, the problem is that that kind of position is, I would argue, like a rational position, but people want to bucket you into one of two camps in the West because that's where most people are, reasonably so. Yeah. And yeah, right. So that's kind of my position on COVID. It's something which I think is like, you know, most people weren't prepared for 10 years of Iraq. Most people aren't prepared for 10 years of COVID. The bad thing about it is going to be all the surveillance stuff that we've got. When I say 10 years of COVID, what do I mean? I say there's a possibility, not a probability, but a possibility that there, if you're looking at some of the work I'm looking at, that there's immune escape, you know, like essentially efficacy versus vaccines is coming down. The flu has a totally different, you know, architecture at the genetic level. I won't be super technical, but it has a different architecture, which makes it more mutable. However, it looks like COVID is managing to do some immune escape. There's websites like NextStrain and so on to track it. What's that likely to result in? Probably booster shots every X number of months. That, of course, won't be taken by people. It's just something where there'll be a fracturing of society on this. I think that over time, the one good thing that comes out of this that I'm seeing is sort of a Y-shaped recovery, where there's much more investment in fitness tracking, in home gyms, in personal health, in glucose meters, in all that type of stuff. Because I think that's a thing that people can agree on, which is, I want to track my own health. I don't trust the CDC or the FDA or the UK equivalents thereof, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, you say that, but you know, you're talking about people actually wanting to take personal responsibility over their health and home gyms and all that, but I just disagree. I think we're moving down a path of laziness where nobody wants to take responsibility for anything. Of course people do, but I'm just generalizing. You know, I think in America, they were sort of saying, we'll give you a free donut if you come take a vaccine. I mean, like, this is a public health thing.
I didn't see that. Say that.
Yeah. It's just like, open the damn gyms. Like, go say, if you go to the gym and you do a good workout, well, you can have the vaccine. You know, I'm just... To me, it's all just very strange. And I think we are moving down this, I wouldn't say dystopian future or this dystopian path, because I do agree with you that there is a lot of plus sides to things, especially with technology and cryptocurrency. And I think that one of the questions somebody actually asked was, ask Malagis what he thinks some of the key skills people need to survive the next two decades. Because like you said, I do think COVID will be a decade situation. Like, let's just say Brexit as an example, as a British person, that went on for 4 or 5 years. This is going to be a decade thing. I don't think it's going to be as difficult as the last 18 months have been, but it's a lot of the stuff isn't going to go. So how do we, from an entrepreneur standpoint, how do we survive the next 20 years? Because jobs that people are doing now will become majorly redundant for many different reasons, whether it's tech or whether it's COVID, whatever it is.
That's right. So basically, like, you know, what is my ideal, right? My ideal is a, you know, so to caricature, right? And this is a caricature, but the Democrat wants more government, the Republican wants less government, the Libertarian wants no government, and the technologist wants a new government, right? How to start a new country, how to start new states, you know? And so the reason I think about this is I think that what we're in the middle of is essentially the unbundling and rebundling of legacy nation states. If you think 2020 was lit, you know, I think the 2020s are going to be litter, okay, so to speak. And what I mean by that is the shocks to the system, you know, the 2001, you know, like 9/11 attacks, the 2008, you know, financial crisis, 2020, you know, Corona and so on. These are, you know, like essentially like a larger and larger and larger ruptures, right? That they do die down, you know, in the sense of like resources are thrown at them, they die down, but a new normal is attained, right? A new normal of surveillance, a new normal, like, you know, post 9/11, obviously way more surveillance, post 2008, all of these, like, you know, financial regulations and so on put in place, post 2020, right, a bunch of stuff, but also a new level of resistance to that, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like pushing in both sides of high centralization and decentralization. And so I think this is like the story of the century, that fight between centralization and decentralization. I think that, you know, you asked what should your viewers or whatever do. So for those who can, I would say learn computer science and statistics. And I really mean that. Okay. Why? Because those are general skills. Okay. General skills, like just what physics was to the early 20th century. Of course, physics is still valuable. You should learn physics. It's great. Okay. However, what's interesting is think about, okay, let me ask you a question. What percentage of your time do you spend looking at a screen?
Too much.
Too much.
Let's say, like, 80%. I don't know. 80%. It's terrible. It's really bad.
Okay. So here's the thing, Leia. Most of the rest of your life will be spent in the matrix.
Okay.
Okay. Meaning, like, most of your waking hours are being spent in an artificial, virtual, constructed world. It's on a screen today. It'll be in VR or AR glasses or something like that tomorrow. That's where the economy is going. That's where all of these things are going. You know, have you tried Oculus Quest 2?
No.
Okay, it's worth trying because it's actually really good. Like, let's say, you know, it's actually immersive in a really interesting way. You forget that you're in physical space. You need a.
That freaks me out. Oh, I have shivers thinking about it.
Fine. So there's also AR glasses that just give an overlay on the world, so you still know where you are, right? And there'll be other kinds of things like this. One way of thinking about it is. When were you born? 1990? Something like that?
A little earlier.
You're not supposed to ask. Let's say sometime in the 90s, probably.
It's okay. Yeah. It's okay. I'm a 90s baby. Yeah.
Fine. Okay. So, you know, at that time, each day you could count how many communications, electronic communications you initiated. And most of the time it was zero, right? Like, we remember a time before the internet. Now today you cannot count how many electronic communications you've initiated because, you know, like, the number of packets we're sending back and forth here, if you have a Fitbit, if you have a this, if you have that, you're just constantly sending these, you know, electronic communications. And, you know, this is also going to be happening with transactions, like the number of electronic transactions you're sending, your economic complexity is rising.
I'm still here. Yeah, it's just my camera. I'm here.
Yeah. So essentially, like, the virtual world that we all live in is just like building up like virtual girders, building around. And people are going to spend way more time there for several reasons. First, the devices are improving, okay?
Yes.
Second, we're going to a world where physical is a premium product. We're maybe arguably already there. What I mean by that is in the 1990s, you know, there was this concept of the digital divide. Do you remember that?
No. I was a baby in the 1990s.
Okay. All right. So 1990s, essentially, the idea was, you know, some people aren't online, there's a digital divide, they're not advantaged, and so on and so forth. Now today, we actually are starting in Western countries, you know, like basic countries that have internet penetration, we're starting to see the physical divide, where it's cheap to put, you know, millions of transistors, you know, on a chip, but it's expensive to put thousands of people in a room, right? Physical is becoming expensive. Physical is becoming a premium product for several different things. Okay. Number one, for example, plane travel. Zoom is much faster than that. You know, like basically anything that you do digital first, right? Communication.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Are you writing a physical letter or you're writing a message? Every single thing that you can think of, if you can do digital first, it's cheap because it's just electrons working, right? Okay. Number one. Number two is AI is coming online in a really big way. So Sam Altman, who's, you know, my colleague, actually tweeted something like this, that he thinks a lot of things, jobs that are done on a screen, the price of them is going to deflate, drop very fast, faster than actually offline things like plumbing and so on until robotics gets good. And that will cause some weird things. I was coming at it from a third direction, which is in the event that inflation happens. So I was coming at it from the crypto rather than the AI direction. In the event that inflation happens, it will disproportionately hit physical things. You know my argument as to why? Can you guess it?
It will disproportionately hit physical things. Why?
Because lumber or, you know, oil or food, those are physical goods and scarce. But the marginal cost of serving you another file from Dropbox is not that much. So it might, you know, going from 0.00001 cents, even 10xing that, is not really that noticeable if the marginal costs are low, right? So as the world outside becomes more and more and more expensive, and the digital world becomes cheaper thanks to AI, and you know, because everybody's got these phones and so on, you have something where physical becomes a premium product, and more and more life is spent basically in the matrix. Now, I recognize there's lots of bad stuff about that world, okay? However, and I think that we can use that world to break out into a better physical world. We'll come back to that point. However, in that intervening period of like digital first, physical as a premium product, you want to learn computer science and stats because that's how you shape what's on screen. Computer science is the algorithms and data structures, and stats is how you do calculations on those data structures, statistical analysis thereof. Anything, you know, Tesco, I know that's a big shop in the big business in the UK. You go into Tesco, you know, CS and stats, they can point you to the database, you can add value. You want to go to Boeing, you can add value. You go to Pfizer, you can add value. Everybody has algorithms and data structures. And so that's a way, a lens of looking at the world that's going to give dividends for many years to come. Let me pause there.
Yeah. So just on that point where you say that, you know, everybody needs to start learning the new technical way, computer science and everything like that. It makes me laugh just because it reminds me of that meme where people say, learn to code, right?
Yeah, yeah,
there was
sure.
that meme that was going on and it was, you know, learn to code. And it is a meme and it is funny because not everybody can learn to code. And this is...
Wait, let me jump in on that. So,
okay.
So learn computer science and statistics or... learn to add value to somebody who can, right?
Okay, but how do you add value when all your, look, like the man that's 60, 70, how does he, even men that are, I say men, women as well, sorry, whatever, but even right. even people that are in their 40s now or higher, you know, if they haven't grown up with this new world of technology or aren't necessarily in weren't you know paying an interest in it when they were much younger, it's very difficult to make that shift. Let's take sure. truck drivers as an example, right? 20 years ago you're a truck driver. Yes, you still had access to the internet and social media and all this stuff, but it wasn't really that hot. And you know, you're not really going to start learning to code at 40, 50, you're just not, especially 60 onwards. So right. what does that mean for a large portion of society? And I think it's Andrew Yang who's really big on this. He talks about universal basic income because it's not fair to some people that we are moving into this futuristic future, if you like. So what do we do? Because not everybody can actually learn computer science and things like that. I'm not even techie. I've been able to find value in what I do, which is great. I'm not techie. I just have an interest in, I'm just interested in freedom, to be honest, and I like to speak. So I've done fine. But what if other people can't do that? Then what?
Okay, so several things. So first is, it's a multi-pronged answer. So first there, you know, I'm investing in things like Lambda School. It's also Maven. There's other things like this that actually are showing traction on retraining. And they do so by basically just, they take like a Walmart clerk who has enough persistence and they train them to become an engineer. Okay.
But how old are you talking though? How old?
In their 30s, right? So, you know, actually, I don't know. I don't want to speak out of turn. I actually do not know the age distribution of the people there, right? But I do know that they've actually had significant success with folks who are outside of traditional venues because, you know, one of the things they're doing is like objective-based learning where they just keep, they're like, you will learn how to do this, and they just keep doing it over and over until people get, they debug it over a lot of folks. That's Lambda School, there's others, okay? But some of the retraining stuff is starting to work. And so I think that that's actually an important piece, number one. Basically, if you think about it with computers, we should be able to do education much better. You can track all kinds of inputs and outputs. You can see whether someone's getting the problem right and what their stimulus was. So it's plausible that insofar as the brain itself is a computer, that we can track I/O and apply that computer science and statistics to figure out how to do the I/O better, okay? You're basically installing software. Let me come back to that, by the way. Let me bookmark installing software in the brain. So one is, I'm not totally giving up on retraining. Number two is Ben Horowitz's point, which is the jobs of the future are harder to predict because, like, we know what the jobs of the present are. We don't know what the jobs of the future are. If you think about it, like, you know, the Industrial Revolution transition, everybody bemoaned the transition from the farm to the manufacturing floor. Now, whatever 100, you know, like about 100 years later, people bemoan the fact that manufacturing jobs are going away, right? Okay, so what do I think, you know, if the 1800s was farming and the 1900s was manufacturing, what is the 2000s? I actually think it's both totally obvious and non-obvious, which is the 2000s, this century, is about investing. Let me explain what I mean by that. That's to say, everybody becomes an investor. Just like the internet, the, you know, social media turned everybody into a publisher, cryptocurrency is going to turn everybody into an investor. This has already happened. Why? Because, okay, maybe you agree, right? So great. So it's Robinhood, it's Coinbase, it's venture capital, it's angel investment. It is, you know, obviously like everything that you can do, the blockchain, it's DeFi, it's all of this stuff, right? And concretely what that means is a larger and larger percentage of people's income is gonna come from capital gains. If you could plot that, I think that's gonna start rising, okay? There's an interesting flip sometime by mid-century, maybe sooner, maybe later, where the 99% are capital and the 1% are labor. What I mean by that is, so that's a flip of the 20th century. In the 20th century, you thought of like the investor as being rich and the, you know, the worker as being poor, right? Capital were the 1% and labor is the 99%. In this century, it may flip where everybody's an investor, but there's a tiny percentage of founders who are able to take capital, which is flowing like water on this internet, and turn it into a useful product. This, by the way, I think is one of the least appreciated things. Lots of people think that if you have money, it's just click your fingers and you can build a spaceship, right? No. You have money, click your fingers, electric car, right? Or even, you know, like a genetic test or Dropbox, right? It's not that easy. If you've ever done capital allocation of any kind, like actually running a business, starting a business or anything, it's just not something you can't buy a spaceship off the shelf, right? It's people think that because something is easy or looks easy, that it was easy to build, and it's not at all, right? That interface, the API of put in a dollar, put in a pound, get back, you know, like a pencil, as that famous story goes, you know, like it's really hard to create a pencil, right? You know what I'm talking about from?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like the lead and the pencil and the eraser.
Yeah, I know, everywhere, and everyone does every part, and yeah.
Exactly, and the API is very simple, which is put in the money, but the thing is actually ridiculously complicated. Okay, so I think that everybody becomes an investor. You just have to click a button online on Robinhood, on Republic.co, on AngelList, on, you know, this or that app to invest nowadays. So it's similar to the experience of Amazon, but it's very different because you now have skin in the game. You're tracking it, right? Now there's huge downsides. You know, if you think about for all the CEOs or whatever, you know, watching this, like, I know a lot of CEOs have had like bad board members or something. Think about the worst board member you ever had. 1,000x worse is a retail investor, right? They're the most short-term, flighty. They don't even know what the heck is going on much of the time. I'm sympathetic to them, of course,
but we need to build structures that accommodate this 10, 100,000x increase. And one of those things is going to be provable on-chain alignment. So people aren't, quote, scamming people or doing short-term things. You want long-term holding. You want like 1,000 different on-chain assertions, basically that decentralized regulation that kind of, I shouldn't say replaces the SEC, but becomes the exit to it, right? An alternative that other countries can adopt, you know, just like you could exit the Fed, right? Okay. So that's the second part of it. Everybody becomes an investor. That is something that everybody can do, but you know, it is, quote, gambling-like in the sense that you may or may not achieve a good outcome. All right, what's the third thing? So first is retraining. Second is everybody becomes an investor. And so it's a multi-part thing. I'm not seeing any one of these, okay? The third is there are new jobs arising, okay? You know, you're an influencer. I'm not sure if you're a professional influencer, but that's basically what, you know, one might call you, right? Something like 20% of America wants to grow up to be YouTube stars. The reason that actually might be not as insane as people think is there is an enormous amount of time spent looking at screens. Our entire consumption pattern has shifted. Content is a larger and larger percentage of the day. It has increased to X. So the market for content has increased. People are paying, you know, online for this content now, which they weren't 20 years ago. So content creation is a third thing, which people can do. And why is that important? Because if, you know, one of my sayings is, if code scripts machines, media scripts humans. Okay, number three. Number four, robotics. This is actually coming online in a big way. So if you look at Vicarious.com, if you look at Boston Dynamics, the robotic future is happening. Now, we need to push this farther, faster, okay? Why? Because on the other side of the robotic transition, you have the hyperdeflation of prices due to the fact that lots of things can now be made by basically electricity, right? You charge the robot what you want to do. The intervening thing will be very disruptive as lots of people are put out of work, but it's like the Industrial Revolution transition. You want to catch them with some of the other things. Okay. So I mentioned retraining. I mentioned everybody becomes an investor. I mentioned robotic automation. What was number three? What did I say?
Number three. You said retraining, everybody becomes an investor, robotics. What was the fourth one?
There's another one that I just mentioned. I forget, but I'll come back to it. Content creation, right?
Oh, content creation. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know the thing is that, and then number five is this is actually a big one, very big one. The new blue collar, you know, I don't really like this framing of it, but I'll use it because I don't have something better yet. The new white collar, blue collar is like above the API, below the API. Have you heard this concept before?
No, I'm waiting to hear what you're going to say.
If you're an Uber engineer, you're coding the API, and if you're an Uber driver, the API is telling you what to do, right?
Yeah.
This is like, you know, some people frame this as incredibly dystopian and bad. I actually don't think it's that different from a factory manager and an assembly line worker. If you romanticize manufacturing jobs, the APIification is just like a decentralized factory floor, right? It's like a bunch of people are being given direction by a manager, but it's in the form of code and it scales a little better. It's a little more, you know, predictable and so on. There's bad aspects, obviously. You know, the algorithm can you know, lower your prices or surge you or whatever in other ways. But so long as there's competition, and that's what we should want. We should want competitive businesses. We should want Lyft. We should want Tesla's taxi service if that comes up. Then you have an equilibrium, hopefully, that is reasonable. So that's potentially a huge catchment for a number of blue-collar workers. Yes, the factory worker may not become an engineer, but they certainly probably can become an Uber driver or something like that, right? Okay. So that's five, right? Six is the unknown. The unknown is like a very large category because predicting the future in detail is not obvious. If you had told people, you know, in 1980 that, you know, like computer engineer would be the most popular job in, you know, 2020, like computers just weren't that popular, right? A lot at the time, you know, Steve Jobs was marketing computers like the early Apple Mac and stuff around that time.
Back in the 80s, yeah.
It was so limited in memory that he was talking about using it for like storing recipes. Okay. Now, and because you could do computation with it, you could store recipes. The internet connectivity wasn't there. The games really weren't that impressive. And there's some stuff. It was okay. But you really had to believe in this computer thing, right? To think that it would be such a large percentage of the economy, you had to have some vision, right? So six, what kinds of things do I think arise in the future? Okay. Drone repairmen. Okay, robotics, all the servicing of all the stuff will be a big thing, okay? Lots of stuff lived by medicine. For example, do you know what a phlebotomist is?
A phlebotomist? Somebody, some sort of chemist of some sort, right?
Well, it's somebody who takes your blood, right?
Oh, mobile, okay.
Yeah, so mobile phlebotomy, I think, is going to become a really big thing. Why? Because people can get blood tests on the go everywhere, right? And that's way more convenient. Basically, you're going to the doctor and having to take blood and do tests.
Yeah.
Okay. You get like these kind of data points, right? The problem is often those data points are like extremely episodic. And really what you want is like a continuous measurement, just like your graph from your website clicks or something like that. You just want one stat, you want it over time, right? Mm-hmm. So mobile phlebotomy, and that's just one like sort of blue collar job within health. You know, hospice care as people age, there's going to be more of that. Everything related to, you know, babies and elderly people, I think will surge because that's the stuff that you kind of want care. You don't want a robot to do it, right? And so
like,
I think,
you think that will be human. That will be human interaction.
That's going to be human, I think, for a while until you can have an extremely emotive robot that's very hard to do. And all the homeschooling push, homeschooling has increased and surged in a big way because there's these woke schools, they're shut down, you know, they're teaching, like all this stuff. So people are going to homeschools because it's better education and whatnot. And then they're realizing actually that you can separate out, at least for those kids beyond a certain age, you can separate out the babysitting component of school, right, from the education component of school. And you factor those out into essentially somebody who is watching the kids and then like the super advanced like learning apps that they're doing, you know? So it's almost like they're supervising their work on the learning apps. So that's a relatively low skill, you know, job that people can do. Yeah, I'm not saying it's bad, but it's not requiring computer science. You just know how to punch some buttons on an app, make sure the kids don't hurt each other. And you can be like the kind of back to the future, the one room schoolhouse, you know, the one room schoolhouse for like, you know, 10 people, right? Okay, that's another job that I think is gonna surge. Let's call it, it's not exactly homeschooling, by the way. It's like community schooling or community school teacher or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Crowdfunded community school teacher. I don't think we have a name for this yet. Maybe we do, maybe I haven't paid attention to it, but something like that. Okay, other things. Biomedicine in general, I think, is gonna soar, and all the things associated with that. I think, you know, like the entire crypto supply chain, of course, is coming, and you know, that's many things. A lot of it is skilled, of course, but you've got the investing stuff that I mentioned. But you'll have people also who are doing data and putting data online, like weather reporting and so on for crypto oracles, so that people can quote make bets on like, you know, the whether a field is going to get rained on. Last, I would say that more of the future jobs, I can project some of them based on things like drones, like robotics, like crypto, like bio. Space is actually becoming bigger, you know, so yes. Space mechanic, that's becoming bigger and bigger. Like people are able to launch satellites. So a lot of the future that we were promised is coming. Electric car repairmen, blah, 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 all those kinds of things. Construction, I actually think we're going to have a huge build out in the middle of America in remote areas. Because people will have houses in the middle of nowhere because they want to kind of get away from people and have kind of intentional communities. So I think that that's going to be a big area. So that's physical or at least supervising robots, okay? And so on and so forth. I think, you know, can I pick which ones of these is going to be absolutely massive? Hard to say, okay? I do think that, bio I'm pretty bullish on. But one of the things that's hard is sometimes jobs like elevator operator, you know, they were really big and then they're really small and we don't really think of them as jobs. They're really kind of, you know, small things, or like taking care of horses. That was a huge thing, not a big thing anymore, you know? So that's some of the things I think that people will do. I know that was a long answer, but I'll...
Yeah.
Right? So, last thing, number 7, the hyperdeflation of cost if you remote work, okay? So yes. For a lot of anybody who can remote work or anybody who can move can actually do really well in this environment because they can arbitrage the entire world, right? They can go to the place that most suits them. So even if physical prices are rising, they can bring those costs down by using essentially a geographical search engine to find the best place for themselves to live and work. So these are different ways that you can kind of adapt to this coming world. It's an incomplete list. You can probably sort yourself into those categories. Maybe afterwards I'll look at the transcript and kind of sort it a little bit more, but those are some of my thoughts. Go ahead.
Yeah, firstly, wow, that was very, very thought through. Really, really, really fascinating, really interesting. I think that I really thought the whole idea of everybody becoming an investor is absolutely spot on. You know, I've got friends who aren't interested in finance or anything like that. And suddenly, you know, now England's out of lockdown, kind of. We meet up and everybody's sort of buying this, everyone's buying that. And it's really shocking. And you also make an interesting point, because when I was younger, everybody wanted to grow up and be a singer, a dancer, or a footballer. Now everybody wants to be a content creator and an influencer.
Let me, give, major asterisk on the everyone wants to be an investor thing, super, super important asterisk, which is at the beginning of, you know, the Weimar hyperinflation, everybody thought they were getting rich. You know, market was up, all this printed money was out there. There's so-called, you know, the Cantillon effect, where like people get that early on, everybody thinks they're becoming millionaires, and new fortunes were created. But the only people who retained those fortunes were people who put some or a big chunk of it into gold or other hard currencies that were not German mark, right? So I think that actually this economy, I actually do think there's essentially two drivers, right? One is the state printing all this money, which is going to cause at some point like significant inflation. It's already starting. And so that will cause, you know, Bitcoin to rise. So I definitely advise people who are concerned about inflation, buy Bitcoin, hold Bitcoin. Do not sell Bitcoin, hold your Bitcoin, right? And if you can learn how to hold your Bitcoin locally, not on exchanges, but even if you can only buy on exchanges, you know, do that, right?
Yeah.
So that's one. And then number two is, I actually do think that we are moving into this digital first world. So I think that tech will continue to do well in a fundamental way. But I think that, folks who are not sophisticated investors or who are not holding BTC could very much lose their shirts in this environment, which will make people mad. Okay. So I'm definitely not saying go out and gamble your money or anything like that. If you only buy one thing, buy Bitcoin. You know, bookmark this. Okay. If you're a sophisticated person, you can potentially do better than that, but that's like the no op, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Go on. Go on.
The no op basically means the action you take in the absence of, it's basically a computer instructions that says, don't do anything, right? Buy Bitcoin, hold a Bitcoin. And that's kind of your insurance policy. And just, you just hold it. You don't touch it. You don't look at the price every day. You go about your life because it's whatever percentage of your net worth that you can essentially write it off, right? But it's your insurance policy. So that will cause, in some ways, some disillusionment with everybody becomes an investor, and will polarize people against it. But I think it will also kind of lead to that world, because Bitcoin holders are investors in a sense, right? They make a projection of the future. There's something else, by the way, I wanted to return to, which is actually your point about Yuri Bezmenov and how it's only sensed when there's a physical actuation, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So in software, we are able to determine whether bits have been installed on a machine, right? If you go and you right-click an app, you will see the signature and the certificate, which shows who developed it, you know, what website it came from. You can probably, if you want to, figure out who the CEO of that was and who the software developers were. And, you know, if it's open source, even you can go back and find the lines of code that are running on your computer, right? You can track its origin. Okay. And as a consequence of this, as partly a consequence, we can do things like track download stats. We can track internet traffic. We can see BitTorrent, and we can see, you know, like SMTP and these various protocols on the web. You can track website popularity, the ebb and flow. You can track all of these things. Okay. What we are not as good at tracking, we're getting better at it, but what we're not as good at tracking is not the code that is installed on hard drives, but the ideas that are installed in minds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the thing is that, I'm trying to give a, okay, here's a good example, abolish the police, okay? That snippet, right, those three words, you've heard it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's actually like software. That it was a slogan that was developed by somebody and optimized. It could be effectively an emergent thing where, you know, somebody said it and then other people modified it and so on. Or it could be literally like a call to arms. Actually, a better example, which we know was developed, was Occupy Wall Street and, you know, the 99%, right? There's actually an article on, you know, how they came up with the propaganda poster. This is like 8 or 9 years ago. Some of your viewers may not remember it, but I think it was Adbusters in Canada that came up with the idea to occupy Wall Street and the memes and so on and so forth, and they pushed it out there, right? And then millions of people are talking about the 99% of the 1%, but that polarization, that frame, that was effectively advertising marketing collateral that was developed by smart people in conference rooms, right? Or whatever it was that the Adbusters office is, right? And so that's code that is executing in your brain where you don't have an origin for it, right? It's not like software, it's not digitally signed. You don't know where it came from, right? Most people aren't even thinking about the fact that it came from somebody. In fact, to say that it came from somebody is considered, quote, conspiracy theory, paranoia, whatever. However, with Twitter, you can actually root cause And if you're good at Twitter search, you can find who like the first person to say something was, right?
Okay.
At search.twitter.com, you can do basically look for keywords. You can find out like, when did this meme originate, right? Like it's a digital thing where you can trace it back, memetic archaeology, just like we trace back the origins of COVID, or well, that's a hard one because China's—
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Yeah. But let's say a virus in general, you can, one that's not political and controversial, you can trace it back to where it came from, right? You can trace back individual genes to figure out where they came from, right? We can do the same with memes. We can trace them back. Now, one issue is that Twitter makes this challenging because it's a corporate database. Not everybody has access to the so-called historical power search API. In fact, very few people do. That's an arcane API, which you need enterprise access to and Twitter's permission to look at all the tweets ever, okay? If you could look at all the tweets ever, you could determine and when and who spread certain memes that eventually took over the world, right? Who are the initial promoters of it, and so on and so forth. You can actually start getting ideological root cause for at least anything that was spread on unencrypted social media. Now, this is what I'm interested in, like decentralized social media. There's several platforms out there, but the key is that these things now have blockchains where you can print out every single equivalent of a tweet. Anybody can do so. And so now you can actually audit this and you can see the diffusion of memes and we can sort of audit our information environment to see who's putting it out there and like who are the initial circulators and, you know, what conflict of interest they have or whatever, right? And you put basically an origin stamp on that, right? I'm not saying necessarily to attack the person. Sometimes the meme is good or harmless or whatever, right? But I am saying to understand, you know, did it come from the wet market or did it come from a lab? Or did it come from, you know, some like zoonotic leap? These are interesting things to know, right? Okay, going a little bit further, you know, if you think about the history of genetics, right? Mendel, you know, came up phenomenologically with the fact that, you know, like the pea plants and the crosses, like, you know, big A, little A, if you remember that from, you know, high school genetics, he came up with some of the laws, you know, Mendel's laws of genetics, which are not full laws, but they apply for, you know, straight dominant recessive characteristics for Mendelian traits. But he didn't know how that actually worked biochemically. He just observed it at a high level phenomenologically, okay? And, you know, Fisher and some of the other early geneticists had a different model for so-called quantitative traits, like height, right? And they had a model where, you know, it would be like more like a bell curve rather than the 0-1 of Mendelian genetics. It failed to later scientists to determine, okay, the structure of DNA, in this sort of so-called neo-Darwinian synthesis, which is the molecular biology of the gene. That is to say, how a gene could give rise to both the individual Mendelian characteristics as well as collectively to things like height. Okay, why am I talking about this? Because what remains to be done is for us to figure out what the molecular neurology of the meme is. Okay, these memes float around. How are they stored in our brains? How are they accessed? How are they represented? How are they deleted? How are we vaccinated against them? We have only really the faintest understanding of this stuff. We're starting to get better at it with things like Neuralink, with some of the work by, you know, guys like Nick Leulis going back 20 years on brain-machine interface. You know, some of the work on the so-called, I think, the Jennifer Aniston neuron, you know, where specific memories or associations of things appear to be stored in like particular neurons. Like the Jennifer Aniston neuron famously would light up, not just when you heard about Jennifer Aniston, but when you heard about Friends, you know, because she was on that show, right? And we're also seeing things in artificial neural networks that seem to have similar characteristics, which seem to recognize like the concept of an eight, you know, like not just the number eight, but it's spelled out eight. You know, it's like eight dots and so on and so forth. We're starting to see these kinds of things. Artificial neural networks, it's like you've got a brain of that you can kind of poke and trigger and see this stuff, right? Once we understand better the molecular neurology of the meme, how memes are stored and represented, once we understand better how to audit social networks and decentralized media, I think we will understand better how to both promote and vaccinate against, you know, bad memes like wokeism, like communism. We'll actually understand how to deal with media corporations that are spiking the equivalent of sugar into every story, putting, you know, the patriarchy or whatever into every headline in order to sell copies. One way of doing that, for example, is to have Chrome plugins that are decentralized where you can view all the code, but that auto read an article for you and that highlight in red all the trigger words that are meant to get you angry. And that like auto substitute, right? It's literally, remember my thing about the food taster and the dipstick at Starbucks? Yeah. It's like that for the untrusted environment of media, where you're like, oh, this guy actually spiked it with 15 rage words that I might not have been aware of. unless I had seen these nutrition facts on the side, which this app gives us, right? Go ahead.
No, that's interesting. That was a lot of information. I'm just digesting.
Okay, go. Jump.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. Just to think that we could move to a world where we have those trigger words, and people can sort of decide for themselves, you know, whether they want to go forward and indulge, and you know, whether it is likely to purposely either be political or aggravate you or whatever it is. But these decentralized apps, and I know that you're really interested in these things like BitClout and whatever, but I'm not going to go into it because time and everything. But just on a last point, I know that decentralization is obviously the goal for a lot of people, is for me to some extent. But I'm often quite skeptical about the how successful they will be, right? So like people don't like YouTube, for example, because censorship, Twitter, because of censorship and all the stuff that we've spoken about. Of course, you have competitors or equivalents. We have like LBRY Library, which is supposed to sort of be the decentralized version. You know, you've got BitClout, which is getting a lot of
space, by the way.
Say that again.
You're knowledgeable about the space. LBRY, is good. I'm an investor in that. Like, you know a lot of the technologies. I'm impressed. So I know I've seen your show before, but you have more. You know some of the more obscure things, which I think a lot of people in crypto don't even know about. Not to beat up an LBRY if you're watching, I think it's actually quite good, but it hasn't yet been widely used. But I think it's starting to get traction as a decentralized YouTube.
But I still think, what I'm saying is, I think that a lot of the time the user experience is really unfriendly. I don't really love YouTube, but I'm on it just because I have to be on it. This show is live on YouTube. It's not going to be on LBRY Library. Sure. You know, we had Parler, which isn't decentralized, but it was supposed to be the competitor, and that obviously had issues. So I'm just wondering, you know, whether we really will be able to get to a place whereby we have decentralized applications, which brings the power back to the people. You know, it takes away any concerns about censorship. Again, I'm not going to get into it because of time, but I also think, you know, what happened with Donald Trump was awful. So in terms of the user experience, do you really think we're going to get to a place where everybody finally migrates?
Short answer, yes, but let me give a slightly longer answer. So first is, in tech, stuff doesn't work until it does. It just wins like vertically, right?
Okay.
You know, Ethereum like had like fits and starts and then just went totally vertical. DeFi was basically kind of flat and then went vertical in 2020 when people figured it out. DeFi summer happened. Virtual reality was flat for a long time, lots of fits and starts, and then Oculus was just this huge leap forward. People tried Webvan in the early 2000s and the tech wasn't there, and then 20 years later, Instacart is massive, right? Things like Cosmo for delivering things in the early 2000s, late 90s, that also was infeasible. But then once you had $100 billion build out of mobile phones and so on, the capital infrastructure was there, and then you could have instant delivery of everything and so on and so forth. There's lots of, AI, we've been working on it for 50 years. Things people thought were easy turned out to be hard. Things people thought were hard, some cases turned out to be easier than we thought. Chess turned out to be easier than driving a car, for example, though most people wouldn't think of it that way. This is like Moravec's paradox. I don't know if you're aware of this, but logical reasoning is relatively easy for a computer. What's hard is sensorimotor stuff, like balancing, okay, driving, and things like that. That requires massive computation. So the thing about it, the thing about software in particular, is when it works, it can just go whoosh, totally vertical. So anything that's a sensor or an actuator, the robotic stuff, that's harder because it's hardware. It's harder to iterate on it. The cycles are slower. Anything that's software, the decentralized stuff is software, when it works, it will take off with no warning, beyond just following the space every, like really closely and being like, okay, they figured it out. You figure out how to scale blockchains. Like actually, if you look at Polygon or BSC, scalability is now happening on, both Ethereum and Ethereum-like chains with some compromises, yes. But, you've got Solana, you've got Avalanche, you've got Near Protocol, you've got Polkadot, you've got all these guys who are working on this. So that scalability then allows people to do more sophisticated things. There's a lot of cryptography, by the way, that's involved with that. Let me actually make a few comments on that just for a second, okay? Just as a plausibility thing, for those of your audience who know about error correcting codes, if you send N bits and there might be an error in them, the obvious thing to do is just resend that message over and over again and then hope that you can kind of do best of three and be like, okay, there was a bit flip here and there. It turns out that in mathematics, you can actually do more like log base 2 of N. So if there's 8 bits, you don't have to send it twice, thrice. You don't have to send 16, 24 bits. You can just send another 3 bits, like essentially the error correcting code bit. Why? Those three bits are functions of the other eight. And it turns out if there's corruption, you can detect it and you can ask for a resend only if there's a corruption. And so with advanced math, you can achieve more compression than people might otherwise think. A lot of the recent stuff with like loop ring and ZK rollups and so on uses advanced cryptography, zero knowledge proofs and things, you know, that are allied to achieve compression and to actually get on, you know, on-chain scalability. Now, does the average Joe need to understand this? No, no more than they need to understand Fourier transforms to pick up their phone, okay? But the math is there, the math is coming. So I'm actually bullish on the space in the long run. Let me just say one other thing, which is with all of that said, I think decentralization is a tool, but centralization is also a tool. The goal is to achieve good outcomes. Decentralization basically allows us to pull away our trust from institutions that try to make it obligatory. I don't have to trust the US dollar, right? I don't have to trust, you know, a Wall Street regulator. I can go to another country with a different regulator. I don't have to trust, you know, Twitter or Facebook if you can have decentralized media, right? Basically, though, and this is the critical thing, you know, I think it's a mistake to say it means trust no one. It means you have a choice of who to trust, right? Mm-hmm. Decentralization doesn't mean an absence of leaders, but an abundance of them. And so I think what will happen is, given a choice, people will re-centralize around better leaders. It's not just getting back to the same place, though. It's more like a corkscrew where there's aspects of it that are the same place, but hopefully we're moving up along the Z-axis towards better leadership and so on over time. That's how I think about, you know, the unbundling and rebundling, the decentralization, re-centralization, decentralization. That's just a cycle that happens in computing. It happens in history. It happens in technology. And I think it's also happening here with nations and with states and so on.
Yeah, I certainly don't think it's going to be one or the other. And I even think the rise of CBDCs, which we haven't spoken about, but another time, I definitely think that the rise of CBDCs definitely sort of shows that, because you have the option of, well, eventually we'll have the option of Bitcoin. I don't think that's ever likely to be banned successfully. And then you have CBDC. So, you know, the existence of decentralization versus centralization, I think, will definitely exist. But just finally, it's been so fascinating hearing all of this. I knew when I was putting questions together and topics, I was like, I knew we would talk about a range of different things. So just finally, what are you working on right now? And how can people follow your work and get involved?
Great question. So I've got a site, 1729.com. We're putting out like a newsletter for tasks and tutorials. So learn crypto, earn crypto, also burn calories. We have a proof of workout thing. This is related to something I've been thinking about, which is content that is aligned with the viewer. So that's to say, you read the content and you actually have demonstrable, provable gains in either your portfolio or your learning or your, you know, your weight or your muscle mass or something like that, and you start to be aligned with the reader. So you're not optimizing page views, you're optimizing the improvement in the reader's lifestyle, which has now become feasible because, you know, we have Fitbit, we have you know, like crypto and so on and so forth. Like, what would men's health be in the era of Fitbit? What would Bloomberg look like if all the news and content was scored against your portfolio performance over time, right? So this is a thing I'm thinking a lot about, like what a healthy positive sum content environment looks like. And you know, if you define the metrics, often you can define the entire product because that's what you're actually optimizing. So that's the kind of thing that's on my mind right now. And I'm also writing a book. So go and subscribe to 1729.com. It's free. Put it out there. You'll hear, you know, biology stuff if you want more.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, being able to essentially just provide content directly for the individual. It's not about the survival of whoever's providing it, like, you know, what would Bloomberg look like if it was aligned with people's portfolios. An interesting thought, to be honest. But biologist, I want to thank you so much. It's been so, so interesting. Like I said, I knew that we would have so much to talk about. So it's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on. And thank you, everyone, for watching.
Thank you, Leah. Okay.
Bye. Speak to you soon. Take care. Bye.